You can open your Bibles to the book of Acts, chapter 23. Again, I'll give you just a little bit of background. I don't want to get in the way of the story here because the whole latter end of the book of Acts is simply Luke telling us about Paul making six different defenses for his faith through the end of the book of Acts. It's been my premise that God told Paul to go to Rome and not go to Jerusalem. Paul was determined to go to Jerusalem, and so he went. After he went, he had a terrible time of it. Zero converts. Twice he got to speak. Neither time did anyone believe him. The Jews tried to kill him. They first tried to beat him to death. And eventually the Romans were able to intercede. And you know the story from the last time. Paul was able to tell the Romans that he was a Roman citizen. And so what ended up happening was, even after the Romans had succeeded with him and were going to try to remove him from Jerusalem, that's where we'll pick it up tonight, the Jews, 40 different Jews, or a little more than 40, they said, made a vow that they wouldn't eat or drink until Paul was dead. And so they made a vow that we're going to execute him no matter what. And so that's where we ended last time. We ended right around verse 13. It says there were more than 40 who had formed this plot. And that's where we'll pick up the story. And it says, and they came to the chief priests and the elders, that's the Sanhedrin, and they said, we have bound ourselves under a solemn oath to taste nothing until we have killed Paul. I really wonder how solemn the oath was, by the way, because we know the rest of the story. And they didn't kill Paul, so did they all, you see, die of thirst or starve to death? Or I really wonder what they did, but that's their intention. It says, now therefore you and the council notify the commander to bring him down to you, as though you were going to determine his case by a more thorough investigation. And we, for our part, will be ready to slay him before he comes to this place. So their whole idea was, look, ask for another audience with Paul to clarify some points. And on his way here, and you have to understand something here, he's under Roman guard. So these 40 were willing to kill some Romans in order to kill Paul. That's how serious they were about getting Paul dead, no matter what the cost. And so they said, we'll jump on him then, and we'll make sure this happens. Now, this is an interesting verse. And he says in verse 16, but the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush. That's one of the only things you'll ever read in the scriptures about Paul, his family. There's a lot of speculation. Some would speculate that Paul was clearly married. The reason for it, overwhelmingly, almost all Pharisees are married. And so consequently, they would say, well, he would have been married. But he could have been a widower. We don't know that. He could have been completely disowned by his family, but apparently not all his family. The other question is, remember, Paul is Saul from where? Tarsus. So what's his nephew doing in Jerusalem? See, is his nephew in Jerusalem to study under Gamaliel or someone like that? Or did he move to Jerusalem? Or does Paul's sister live in Jerusalem? Luke doesn't tell us any of that. He apparently doesn't feel that we need to know any of that. And so it says, the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, and he came and he entered the barracks and he told Paul. And Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, lead this young man to the commander, for he has something to report to him. And so he took him and he led him to the commander, and he said, Paul the prisoner called me to him and asked me to lead this young man to you, since he has something to tell you. And the commander took him by the hand and, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately, what is it that you have to report to me? And he said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the council, as though they were going to inquire somewhat more thoroughly about him. Do not listen to him. For more than 40 of them are lying in wait for him, who have bound themselves under a curse not to eat or drink until they slay him. And now they are ready and waiting for the promise from you. Therefore, the commander let the young man go and instructed him to tell no one that you have notified me of these things. And what ends up happening from here through what we go through tonight, there's an amazing tension going on here. As you know, the Romans don't give a whit about what goes on in with Judaism. They have no interest in that, but they have a tremendous interest in peace and quiet. That's sort of the whole idea. If you're going to govern for Rome in a territory, the thing you have to present is peace and quiet to Rome, or you'll be replaced. The Jews are very difficult to deal with. In fact, if you look at it from an earthly point of view, one of the major reasons that Pilate was willing to let Christ be crucified was the political climate. The Jews had made lots and lots of trouble for Pilate. He was in trouble with the emperor on more than one occasion. The Jews always complaining to Rome about whoever was representing Rome in Israel. And what you're going to see here is the people in responsibility here to Rome have a tension that they're going to face the whole way through this, these next two chapters. And that is, how do we make sure that Roman laws are carried out the way they need to be? And how is it that we appease the Jews and don't get them all upset with us? Because if they get all upset with us, they'll go back to Rome. And when they go to Rome, then it ends up falling back on us. So that's sort of the tension that's being played out here. Verse 23, it says, and he called to him two of the centurions, and he said, get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night and proceed to Caesarea. So the idea here of 200 soldiers, 100 for each centurion. Remember, centurion means he's the leader of 100. He said, I want 200 of them, and I want you to go from Jerusalem to Caesarea on the coast. And Caesarea is about 70 miles. So from here to Baton Rouge. He said, that's what I want you to do. He says, with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. So they've got a small cavalry. And clearly, you sort of get an idea here of what it means to protect a Roman citizen. Remember, this guy's not interested in Paul in any other way, except that he found out that Paul is a Roman citizen. And so you can't let somebody murder a Roman citizen without the justice of Rome prevailing. And so he gets it together. It says, they were also, he says, to provide mounts to put Paul on and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. So now he says, look, this problem's getting too big for me. I'm going to send him to the governor. So he wants to send him to Felix. And Felix is a strange fellow. He's never been popular. The Jews gave him lots of trouble. He's been a governor for Rome for about 5 years. And he doesn't last much longer than five. He gets thrown out and Festus is brought in. And the reason he gets thrown out is the Jews are so unhappy with him. So he's not a popular guy at all, but the commander realizes this is a political issue. I'd rather go to Caesarea and be done by the Roman governor than be handled by me in Jerusalem here. So that's what he does. Now, what's interesting, he writes a letter having this form. Claudius Lysias. That tells you something about the commander. First of all, you just read names like that, we don't think about it much. But first of all, remember the commander told Paul he bought his citizenship. Paul said, that's great, but I'm a natural-born citizen, which is even higher. Claudius is his Roman name. Lysias is his real name. It's his Greek name. So Claudius Lysias is a Greek who bought himself Roman citizenship. And so he lets Felix know who he is. He says, Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came upon them with troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. Now notice, he'll omit the part that I put him in chains and I was going to have him flogged. He didn't want to say any of that. He just said, I was there to rescue a Roman. He says, and wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council, and I found him to be accused over questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. So notice his perspective of it is there, he's done nothing. Not because notice he says what he did is certainly not something you could punish by death, but you can't even put him in prison for this. He said, I don't see anything that he's done. There's some question about their law, and they're all in a snit about this. And they certainly are. He says, and when I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to bring their charges against him before you. Now, I'm sure he does that, but I'm sure he does that later. He isn't saying, hey, we're sneaking Paul out of town. You know, he's going to wait till he's there, and you'll see how this works. So the soldiers, in accordance with their orders, they took Paul, and they brought him by night to Antipatris. And what's interesting about that part, Antipatris is right about 35 to 45 miles away from Jerusalem. It's a little bit over halfway. They left at 9 in the evening, and then they took off. And they got about 35, 40 miles. That's a good distance to cover. And they stopped for the night there. That's the holdover place. Next day, they'll go to Caesarea. So he says, that's what ends up happening to them. He then says, but the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they returned to the barracks. So the 200 spearmen went as far as Antipatris. They turned around and went back to Jerusalem. Then the cavalry, so to speak, the 70 horsemen and Paul, they went on to Caesarea. So they could even make better time probably getting there without the infantry. That's kind of an interesting thought when you think about how big a deal this seems to be. He says, and when these had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented him to Paul, Paul to him. And it says, and when he read it, he asked from what province he was. And when he learned that he was out of Cilicia, now remember, he's from Tarsus, so he says, you know, okay, what province are you from? If you're a Roman, he says, Cilicia. He said, I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive also, giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. Herod's praetorium means there's a bunch of Herods, and we'll talk about that a little bit later with Agrippa II. But this is where the governor of it all, the Herod, remember, Herod the Great was the one who was alive. He was the worst of them all, but he was the one alive when Jesus was born. And so when Herod's in Caesarea, this is his residence. So he's put in a sense, the best residence in Caesarea, and it's an easy one to guard, for sure. So that's where he puts him. It says, and after 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders. So you'd now get the idea of the delay. It took Paul 2 days to get there. It took Ananias 5 days to get there. And even if he made it a three-day journey instead of two, that tells you the commander waited at least 2 days before he told anybody where Paul was. So he says, and after 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders. He said, with a certain attorney named Tertullus. Now, this is interesting because Tertullus, again, sounds Roman. And so apparently, the Jews hired a lawyer. Probably told them what they wanted to have say. I mean, it's so much like today's life. They hire a lawyer, and they want this lawyer to argue the case to Felix that they have against them. It won't prevail much because they don't really have much of a case. But so he says, and they brought charges to the governor against Paul. And after Paul had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying to the governor, since we have, through you, attained much peace, he says, and since by your providence, reforms are being carried out for this nation. That's the smoozing part. You know, I mean, no one likes Felix, and he's going to be out. He only lasts 5 years. But he's saying, you've done a phenomenal job. You're like, well, great, you know. We acknowledge this in every way and everywhere. Most excellent Felix, with all thankfulness. It's just spreading on thick. He said, but that I may not weary you any further, I beg you to grant us, by your kindness, a brief hearing. For we have found this man a real pest. Now, I wonder if that's a technical term. You know, I mean, it's hard to imagine in a court of law you'd go to a governor and say, look, this guy's a pest to us. We don't like him. We found this man a real pest and a fellow who stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Now, some of that's true. You see, I think what's going on here, and you're going to see it's going to be carried out in a way it's going to be almost frightening. The hatred that they have for Paul, that's just so enormous, is because of his success. You see, there are literally thousands upon thousands upon thousands of Jews who are believers. not just all the thousands in Jerusalem, but there are Jewish believers in every city Paul went to. And now there are Gentile believers being put together with Jewish believers. From the Jews' point of view, they see what Paul's doing as a complete threat to Judaism. This man is a threat to us. You see, this man would eradicate us. This man would take away everything that we hold to be solemn. This guy's had success everywhere he's been. Had Paul been a failure, they wouldn't be doing this, but he's had so much success everywhere he's been, they're very concerned. He says, and he even tried to desecrate the temple. Now, remember, that went back to last time. They said he brought a Greek into the temple. He did not. He had a Greek with him, but he never went into the temple. He said, but they brought, and then we arrested him, only after he brought a Greek into the temple. So this is lying, okay? Now, the next part's in brackets, and that tells you some of the older manuscripts, Sinaiticus, P46, those kind of manuscripts, don't have this section in it. It says, and we wanted to judge him according to our own law, but Lysias, the commander, came along and with much violence took him out of our hands. We were doing some law-abiding, Jewish law-abiding thing, and Lysias came with a lot of violence and ripped them away from us. Now remember, they were beating Paul to death when Lysias came, but that's not exactly the way they describe it now. Ordering, he says, his accusers to come down before you. And by examining him yourself concerning all these matters, you will be able to ascertain the things which we accuse him. And the Jews also joined in the attack, asserting that these things were so. So you have the same kind of scene, but it's before Felix. And the hard part for the Jews here is the Romans don't care. See, they want peace no matter what. They'll do almost anything for peace. But the idea of nuances of Judaism is something they have no interest in whatsoever. And when the governor had nodded for him to speak, Paul responded. He said, knowing that for many years you have been a judge to this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. Paul's been very relaxed through all this. And he says, and since you can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. He said, and neither in the temple, nor in the synagogues, nor in the city itself, did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or causing a riot. See, Paul's whole view was, look, I went to Jerusalem. I never spoke to anyone. And all I was doing was going into the temple, purification rites for him. And remember, he was paying for the Nazarite vow for the three men that were going to have their haircut shaved off. Paul says, I just went into the temple. I didn't cause any riot in Jerusalem. I didn't even speak to people in Jerusalem up till that point. He says, nor can they prove to you the charges they're now accusing me of. But this I admit to you, that according to the way, and that's the way Paul always refers to it, according to the way which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers. Notice, Paul is not, no matter whether he's Roman or not, he's not going to equivocate on Jesus Christ. He's not going to change his stance on the gospel and who Christ is. This is an opportunity to talk to someone about Christ. He's going to do it. He's not in any way doing something else. He said, believing everything that is in accordance, he says, with the law, and that it is written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men cherish themselves, that, he says, that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. That's his defense. The only thing they can accuse me of is the resurrection. Because remember, his whole faith is based on one fact. Christ was raised from the dead. And being raised from the dead, he encountered Paul on the road to Damascus. So everything about Paul, and remember, Paul did this before, but a lot of the people who would be part of the Sanhedrin, and many of the men that probably went from Jerusalem to Caesarea, are Pharisees. And they believe in the resurrection with all their heart. It's the Sadducees that don't believe in a resurrected life at all. And so Paul goes back and makes his case again, saying exactly the same kind of thing. He said, this is what this is all about. He said, all of this is just something else. This idea, he said, about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And then he says, in view of this, he said, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience before God and before men. Now, after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings, because I'd been gone a long time, in which they found me occupied in the temple, having been purified, without any crowd or uproar. But there were certain Jews there from Asia, and we said that's Ephesus. Paul was spent 3 years in Ephesus, so they knew him by his face. He said, there were certain Jews from Asia who ought to have been present before you, but apparently they're not there, and to make an accusation if they should have anything against me. Or else let these men themselves tell you what misdeed they found when I stood before the council. Other than this, this one statement, which I shouted out while standing among them, for the resurrection of the dead, I am on trial before you today. So Paul reduces the whole thing down that this is only about one statement. The statement was, I believe in the resurrection of the dead. But Felix, having more exact knowledge about the way. See, one thing, Felix is governor the last 5 years. So do you think he's heard about Messianic Jews? People who believe Jesus was alive and resurrected from the dead? What we would call Christians? Of course he does. He knows about them. He has them in Caesarea. Remember, every time Paul stopped in Caesarea, he spent time with believers. So Felix is very much aware of this. He said, but Felix, having more exact knowledge about the way, put them off, saying, when Lysias the commander comes down, I will decide your case. I want to talk to him as well now. I've talked to both of you, now I want to talk to him. And he gave orders to the centurion for him to be kept in custody and yet have some freedom and not to prevent any of his friends from ministering to him. Now, this sounds good, but here's the problem. Felix knows he has no charge against Paul. Felix knows that the high priest in the Sanhedrin can do nothing but make trouble for him. So Felix wants to do what any good politician wants to do. He just wants to buy time. I just want to let it go. I'll tell them I'll do this some other time and we won't have to deal with it. He said, make Paul as comfortable as he can be here, but I'm not going to do anything else. That's what Felix's answer was. And it was a very good one. Some days later, Felix arrived, he says, with Drusilla, his wife, who was a Jewess. Drusilla is the youngest daughter of Herod Agrippa I. Remember in Acts 12, Herod Agrippa, the one who the worms ate? Yeah. She's the youngest daughter. She was known for her beauty. And at 16 years of age, married a king or of a smaller country. Felix found a way to extradite it, and by the time she was 20, he had her. So he brought her in to be part with him. Sort of the way that it works for the two of them. Now, so that's what you find out about her. She's Jewish. And it says, and they sent for Paul, and they heard him, and they speak about his faith in Christ Jesus. And as he was discussing righteousness and self-control and the judgment to come, Felix became frightened and said, go away from the present, and when I find time, I will summon you. So they meet with Paul. Paul meets with them. He talks to them not only just, he talks to them about Christ. He talks to them about life. He talks to them about a future judgment, both the wicked and the righteous. He tells him, and now Felix is scared. Felix has wanted nothing to do with any of this, but now what if this guy's right? So Felix's solution to it all is go away for the present, and when I find time, I will summon you. And at the same time, he was hoping that money would be given to him by Paul. Therefore, he also used to send for him quite often and converse with him. He kept thinking either Paul or his friends will raise money. He knew they raised money to go to Jerusalem. Maybe the people will raise money and give it to Felix. So if they raised enough money, Felix would take it, put it in his... Notice how political this is. I mean, it just sounds like today. But he put the money in his pocket and it would be fine. But the only trouble is every time he summons Paul to see if Paul has money, Paul talks to him about the Lord. But here's the part that is amazing to me. But after 2 years had passed, that's astounding. 2 years in Caesarea. That's a long time. You know, we think that Paul was just going from Jerusalem, he went straight to Rome, No. He spent 2 years in Caesarea, under house arrest, so to speak. Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and wishing to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul imprisoned. See, Felix was heading he was hanging by a thread. And so he finally lost his position. He didn't have it very long, like I said, a little over 5 years. And Festus is brought in. Festus is a little bit different than Felix. Festus, therefore, having arrived in the province, 3 days later went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. Festus probably asked the question, what's this guy here for? You know, I imagine someone said, I don't know, he's been here a couple of years. We're not sure what's going on with him. But he goes up to Jerusalem. And the chief priests and the leading men of the Jews brought charges against Paul, and they were urging him, requesting a concession against Paul, that he might have been brought to Jerusalem at the same time, setting an ambush to kill him on the way. 2 years later, the Jewish Sanhedrin wants him as dead as they wanted him 2 years ago. Now, one thing you've got to say, he hasn't caused any uproar anywhere. He hasn't had a big impact on Gentile cities or Jerusalem. He's in Caesarea. But their vengeful hate for him is just as great now as it was 2 years earlier. They want him dead. No matter what the circumstances are, they want him to be dead. Well, Festus then answered that Paul was being kept in custody at Caesarea and that he himself was about to leave shortly. Therefore, he said, let the influential men among you go there with me, and if there is anything wrong about the man, let them prosecute him. One more time. It says, and after he had spent not more than 8 or 10 days among them, he went down to Caesarea, and the next day he took his seat on the tribunal, the Bema, and ordered Paul to be brought. And after he had arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him, which they could not prove. See, one thing about the Roman court system, it's pretty good. You can make the charge you want, but you have to prove it. See, there has to be proof. And they don't have any proof. While Paul said in his own defense, I have committed no offense either against the law of the Jews or against the temple or against Caesar. Now Paul introduces a word that he's not introduced before. He introduces Caesar. Paul said 2 years to think about this. I want you to think about from Paul's point of view. Remember, Paul told the church of Philippi, if I have a choice to die today or to stay on longer, I'd choose to die. Now, you got to understand, he saw the resurrected Christ. So he kind of has a good idea what heaven's like. I'm ready to die. For your sake, he said, I would stay. Paul keeps thinking, God wanted me to go to Rome. I've got to get to Rome. So that's why he introduces this word Caesar. You're going to see in a moment how he uses it. He said, look, there's got to be a way to get to Rome. And that's what I want to do. But Festus, wishing to the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said, are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me on these charges? And Paul said, I am standing before Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried. I have done no wrong to the Jews, as you also very well know. See, Festus tried to say, come on, Paul, let's go to Jerusalem. And then he goes, no, you're the tribunal of Caesar. I'm a Roman citizen. I should be tried before you. So let's do it. He said, if then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. He said, but if none of those things are true, which these men accuse me, and no one can hand me over to them. And then he says the words, I appeal to Caesar. Now, the part you may not know whether you do your work or not, but guess who's Caesar? Nero. Well, that's an interesting guy. When you think of Nero's history, especially with Christians, Paul says, I appeal to Caesar. Then when Festus conferred with his council, he answered and said, you have appealed to Caesar. He said, to Caesar you shall go. Now, you got to understand Festus' point of view. On a certain level, when Paul said that, he just went, done with it. See, I don't want to put Roman justice against a guy who's innocent. But I don't want the Jews all upset with me. They were upset with Felix, and he's gone. I want to do the Jews a favor. But now that he's appealed to Caesar, it's not my issue anymore. I just send him off to Caesar, and I'm done with it. So from his point of view, I'm sure he felt a great relief from this. He says, now when several days had elapsed, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived. So now we have another character come into this. King Agrippa and Bernice. When you start seeing who these people are, it's kind of an amazing thing that these are the people judging Paul. Ananias is, like I said, Ananias is a mob leader. To call him a high priest has got to be one of the great jokes of all history. The guy is a swindler, racketeer, anything you can imagine. There's nothing righteous about him at all. Felix and Festus are puppets trying to do the political expedient thing. Now the king comes in, King Agrippa. And he is Agrippa the Second. Now, what's interesting about this with the potential of it being Agrippa the Second is that his father, as I said before, was eaten by worms in Acts 12. He is with Bernice. She is his consort. How can I say it? She's his sister. So they have an incestuous relationship. And she's not just having an incestuous relationship with Agrippa. She had an affair with the emperor of Rome. Not Nero, but Vespasian before him. She had several famous affairs. But Bernice is an interesting woman, to say the least. King Agrippa, he doesn't really reign over Jerusalem. His kingdom is northern Israel. However, the northern part of Palestine, he's the nephew of Herod Antipas. He's the great-grandson of Herod the Great. So these guys all kind of go together. He did not grow up in Israel. He grew up in Rome. That's where he grew up, and he got this station in Israel. The only other thing about him is that he finagled it, that even though he was in northern Israel, he controlled the temple and the temple money for Rome. And he was the only one that could appoint a high priest. So now you have Romans appointing high priests for the Jews. I mean, you can just imagine how convoluted this whole thing gets. So these aren't exactly the righteous, upright people that are judging Paul. These are who they are. So he says, after Agrippa and Bernice arrived at Caesarea and paid their respects to Festus. And while they were spending many days there, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, there's a certain man left prisoner by Felix. And when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews brought charges against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation upon him. And I answered them that it is not the custom of the Romans to hand over any man before the accused meets his accusers face to face and has an opportunity to make his defense against their charges. And so after they had assembled here, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought. And when the accuser stood up and began bringing charges against him, he says, not of such crimes as I was expecting. See, he's thinking, wow, capital offense here. What did this guy do? Insurrection against Rome? What did he do? And he said, well, I believe in the resurrection. You know, from his point of view, this doesn't make any sense at all. He says they simply had some points of disagreement with him about their own religion and about a certain dead man, Jesus, whom Paul asserted is to be alive. He said, that's what this is all about. They said he's dead. Paul said he's alive. And being at a loss of how to investigate such matters, I asked whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and to stand trial on these matters. But when Paul appealed to be held in custody for the emperor's decision, I ordered him to be kept in custody until I send him to Caesar. Now watch. And Agrippa said to Festus, I'd like to hear the man myself. Tomorrow, he said, you shall hear him. Now Agrippa's heard of Paul. I'm sure he has. He said, I'd like to hear what he has to say. And so the next day, when Agrippa had come together with Bernice amid great pomp and entered the auditorium accompanied by the commanders and the prominent men of the city, at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. And Festus said, King Agrippa, and all you gentlemen here present with us, he says, behold, this man about whom all the people of the Jews appealed to me, both at Jerusalem and here, loudly declaring that he ought not live any longer. But I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death. And see, since he himself has appealed to the emperor, I decided to send him. Yet I have nothing definite about him to write to my Lord. Therefore, I have brought him before you all, he said, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after the investigation has taken place, I might have something to write. He said, for it seems absurd to me in sending a prisoner and not indicating the charges against them. So he's glad. Look, Agrippa, you're this king. You're a big timer. You talk to him and tell me what charges I can write down that are against this guy so that the emperor doesn't think, what in the world? You see, what in the world is Festus doing? What is he sending this guy to me for? So that's from his point of view. And Agrippa said to Paul, you are permitted to speak to yourself for yourself. And he said, then Paul stretched out his hand and proceeded to make his defense. In regard to all these things which I am accused by the Jews, I consider myself fortunate, King Agrippa, that I am about to make my defense before you today, especially because you are an expert in all the customs and questions among the Jews. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently. So he says, Agrippa, look, you know the Jewish people, even though he's raised in Rome. He said, I'll tell you what I'm going to say, and then you tell me what you think. He says, so then, all Jews know my manner of life from my youth up, which from the beginning was spent among my own nation and at Jerusalem. Since they have known about me for a long time previously, if they were willing to testify that I lived as a Pharisee according to the strictest sect of our religion. So the whole idea, he doesn't use Gamaliel here, but he's used them before. I went to Jerusalem, I was taught by Gamaliel, I am a Pharisee of Pharisees. Agrippa knows that means he's the strictest of all Jews. He says, and now I am standing trial for the hope of the promise made by God to our fathers, the promise to which our 12 tribes hope to attain as they earnestly serve God night and day. For this hope, O King, I am being accused by the Jews. Why is it considered incredible among you people if God does raise the dead? You see, he said, the Jews have hoped in the resurrection of the dead for generations. Now, why would it be so incredible that you come and say God has raised the dead? What would that make any sense at all? He says, so then I thought myself that I had to do many things hostile to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And he said, and this is just what I did in Jerusalem. Not only did I lock up many of the saints in prisons, having received authority from the chief priest, but also when they were being put to death, I cast my vote against them. That tells you that he's been involved in more deaths than just Stephen. And Paul knows it. He says, and I punished them often in all the synagogues. I tried to force them to blaspheme. And being furiously enraged at them, I kept pursuing them even to foreign cities. So these Jews, 2 years later, they're still after Paul, are just like Paul. I think he empathizes with them in that sense, because that's the way he was. He says, while thus engaged, as I was journeying to Damascus, with the authority and commission of the chief priest. And at midday, O king, I saw on the way a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, shining all around me, and those who were journeying with me. And when we had all fallen to the ground, I heard a voice saying to me in the Hebrew dialect, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It's hard for you to kick against the goads. Paul adds that. That's something he had not said before. He didn't have to, but this time he said there was a little bit more. What are you doing? He then says, and I said, who are you, Lord? And the Lord said, I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. But arise and stand on your feet, for this purpose I have appeared to you, to appoint you a minister and a witness. He says, not only to the things which we have seen, but also to the things in which he said, I will appear to you, delivering you from the Jewish people and from the Gentiles, to whom I am sending you, to open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness to light and from dominion of Satan to God, in order that they may receive forgiveness of sins and inheritance among, he says, those who have been set apart or sanctified by faith in me. So he gets the gospel in the whole thing this time. He goes straight to it. Consequently, King Agrippa, I did not prove disobedient to the heavenly vision, but kept declaring both to those in Damascus first and also in Jerusalem, and then throughout the whole region of Judea and even to the Gentiles, that they should repent and turn to God, performing deeds appropriate to repentance. For this reason, some Jews seized me in the temple, and they tried to put me to death. And so, having obtained help from God, I stand, he said, to this day, testifying both to small and great, stating nothing but what the prophets and Moses said was going to take place, that the Christ, the Messiah of Israel, the Messiah, was the sufferer, and that by reason of his resurrection from the dead, he should be the first to proclaim light both to the Jewish people and to the Gentiles. So he gets it all in here, and he's rehearsed it well. And while Paul was saying this in his defense, Festus said in a loud voice, "Paul, you are out of your mind. Your great learning is driving you mad." See, he knows how smart Paul is. You see, the Romans didn't mind you being religious, but Paul's talking about them about something that they have no idea about. Like, we get religion, but this whole idea that you're talking about, a resurrected from the dead and all of that kind of stuff, that's something completely different. It's funny. Paul said, "I am not out of my mind, most excellent Festus. I utter words of sober truth." He said, "For the king knows about these matters, and I speak to him also with confidence, since I am persuaded that none of these things escaped his notice, for this has not been done in a corner." That's a great, great line. "Agrippa, you've heard about me. You've been in cities all over northern Israel. There are believers. You know what I'm talking about. This isn't just some little thing that was done in the dark by one crazy Jew. This is in their world, this is a worldwide movement going on. And you're aware of this." King Agrippa said, "Do you believe the prophets? I know that you do." That's kind of an interesting statement versus what Festus said. He said, "You're believing what the prophet said is going to happen. You believe that there's a Messiah coming to Israel, don't you?" "Yeah." Agrippa replied to Paul, "In a short time you will persuade me to become a Christian." First time the word's used as a group. "You're going to persuade me." See, Agrippa's pretty sensitive to this whole thing. You got to understand, he feels a little awkward. He's a Roman puppet king, and Bernice is his sister. So, I mean, this isn't, you know, but it's interesting. He says to Paul, and Paul said, "I would to God that whether in a short or a long time, not only you, but also all who hear me this day might become such as I am, except for the chains." So he's using it as his opportunity. "This is my chance to speak." And the king arose, and the governor, he says, and Bernice, and those who were sitting with him. And when they had drawn aside, they began talking to one another and said, "This man is not doing anything worthy of death or imprisonment." There's nothing here. There's like absolutely nothing. You can't even put it. We've had him in jail for 2 years. And Agrippa said to Festus, "This man might have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar." So Agrippa would have probably said, "Look, you can go." But Paul would rather have an all-expense-paid trip to Rome than to have to do it on his own, because that's what's going to happen. Okay, now we pick it up. He says, "And when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they proceeded to deliver Paul and some of the other prisoners to a centurion," he said, "of an Augustan cohort named Julius. And embarking, he said, in the Adramyttian ship, which was about to sail to the regions along the coast of Asia, we put out to sea accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica." So Paul is now out to sea. "And the next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul with consideration and allowed him to go to his friends and receive care." Now remember, he's trying to sort of tiptoe his way back across the Mediterranean to get to Rome. "And from there we put out to sea and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary." So we know they had north winds to deal with. So when they leave and are going to cross that part of the Mediterranean, Paul, they sail under Cyprus. In other words, they use Cyprus as a wind barrier, because the seas are going to be really contrary for a sailing ship. He says, "And when we had sailed through the sea along the coasts of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed in Myra," he said, "in Lycia. And there," he said, "the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy, and he put us on board it." So a bunch of little shortstops, and now the Alexandrians are going all the way to Rome. The centurion said, I confiscate the ship we're coming on. I'm taking him to Rome. And so that's what they do. He says, and when we had sailed slowly for a good many days, with difficulty had arrived off, he said, Cnidus. He said, since the wind did not permit us to go further, we sailed under the shelter of Crete. He said, off Salome. And with difficulty sailing past, he said, we came to a certain place called Fair Havens, he said, which was near the city of Lycia. And if you look at that on the map, the problem that they're having is the difficult part in the Mediterranean, normally, is that if you were going from Rome and sailing to, say, Phoenicia, it's usually pretty good sailing because the winds are prevailing westerly. They come from the west and they blow to the east. But if you're sailing from Phoenicia and heading toward Rome, then you've got to really be clever how you sail. You've got to do a lot of tacking. The idea is you're sailing into the wind. And so consequently, that made things very, very difficult for them. Okay. Now it says, when considerable time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous, since even, he says, the fast was already over, he said, Paul began to admonish them. So consequently, what do you have? You have, I skipped a verse, didn't I, about the fast? No, I didn't. Okay. And it said, and he said, men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be attended with damage and great loss, not only to the cargo and the ship, but also to our lives. The centurion, he said, was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship than what was said by Paul. Well, that makes sense, wouldn't it? Paul's not a captain, but he told him. And because the harbor was not suitable for wintering, the majority reached the decision to put out to sea from there if somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. So you can see by the going from the islands, Cyprus and then Crete, they're just trying to get somewhere to stop now. Middle of the Mediterranean, they're not in a good position. And when a moderate south wind came up, supposing that they had gained their purpose, they weighed anchor and began sailing along Crete close to the inshore. And it says, but before very long, there rushed down from them a land of a violent wind called a Euroquillo. That's from the north now. So now they have, coming down off the island, which is mountainous, you got a real strong wind, and that's what you don't need if you've ever been in a little sailboat. Now they're going to be pushed toward out to sea. And when the ship was caught in it, it could not face the wind, and they gave way to it and let themselves be driven along. So they couldn't turn the ship into the wind. And running under the shelter of a small island called Clauda, it says, we were scarcely able to get the ship's boat under control. And after they, he said, had hoisted it up, they used supporting cables and undergirding the ship. And fearing, he says, that they might run aground on the shallows of Syrtis, and they let down a sea anchor, and they let themselves be driven along. All they did is let a anchor drag along the bottom, another device they used just to try to keep themselves stable. The next day, we were being violently storm-tossed. They began to jettison the cargo, just what Paul had said. On the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. So they're just trying to stay alive. And since neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small storm was assailing us, from then on, all hope of our being saved was gradually abandoned. So it's just kind of an interesting story. Nothing in Paul's life is normal. You know, so here he is, they're just trying to get him to Rome, and now he's in the middle of this. When they had gone a long time without food, then Paul stood up in the midst and said, men, you ought to have followed my advice and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this damage and loss. Look, I may not be a captain, but I know the captain, you know, a different captain. And he says, and yet now, he said, I urge you to keep up your courage, for there shall be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night, an angel of the God to whom I belong and to whom I serve stood before me, saying, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar, and behold, God has granted, he says, you all those who are sailing with you. Therefore, keep your courage, men, for I believe God that it will turn out exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on a certain island. So, now, This comes under desperate people do desperate things. So I don't think any other time these guys would have listened, but at this time they're certainly ready to. He says, and when the 14th night had come, and we were being driven about in the Adriatic, about midnight, the sailors began to surmise that we were approaching some land. They took soundings and found it to be 20 fathoms. And a little further on, they found out that it was 15 fathoms. And fearing that we might run aground somewhere on the rocks, they cast four anchors from the stern and wished for daybreak. And the sailors were trying to escape from the ship and had let down the ship's boat into the sea on the pretense of intending to lay out anchors from the bow. He says, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men remain in the ship, you yourselves cannot be saved. So you have a little ship being taken out of the big ship, because everyone's got to be in here. So how do you convince people of this kind of thing? But that's what he says they're going to do. He said, then the soldiers cut the ropes of the ship's boat, and they let it fall away. He says, and until the day was upon about the dawn, Paul encouraged them all to take some food, saying, today is the 14th day that you have been constantly watching and going without eating and having taken nothing. Therefore, I encourage you to take some food, for this is for your preservation. He said, for a hair from your head. He said, for not a hair from your head of any of you shall perish. And having said this, he took bread, gave thanks to God in the presence of them all, and he broke it and he began to eat. And all of them were encouraged, and they themselves also took food. And all of us in the ship, by the way, that tells you, where's Luke? He's in the ship. So this is firsthand for him. No one told him this story. All of us, he said, in the ship, he said, we're 276 people. Good-sized ship for the day. And when they had eaten enough, they began to lighten the ship by throwing out wheat into the sea. And when day came, they could not recognize the land, but they did observe a certain bay with a beach, and they resolved to drive the ship onto it if they could. And casting off all the anchors and left them in the sea while at the same time they were loosening the ropes of the rudders and hoisting the foresail, he said, to the wind, and they were heading to the beach. But striking a reef where the two seas meet, he says, they ran the vessel aground, and he said, the prow stuck fast and maintained immovable, but the stern began to be broken up by the force of the waves. And the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, that none of them should swim away and escape. So there were prisoners on the ship, we'll kill them all. But the centurion, wanting to bring Paul safely through, kept them from their intention. And he says, and commanded them that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get the land. And it says, and the rest should follow, some on planks, others on various things in the ship, and thus it happened. He says that they all were brought safely to the land. And we'll stop there for the night. But so that's what I mean. When you get to this kind of section of scripture in the New Testament, it's very unusual. There's no real lessons being taught. It does show you the difference between the kingdom of God, though, and the kingdom of Lucifer and the hatred. You know, that part is clear. It also shows you that people have always been the same. A politician then and a politician now are still politicians. I mean, people are very much the same of the way this whole thing operates. And Paul's going to get to Rome, but it's no easy task for him. You would have thought that after 2 years of waiting in Caesarea, God would have said, look, I'm going to give you a smooth journey. But he gets no smooth journey at all. But again, he had a chance to witness to 276 guys. You see, in the most amazing way. You see, and they're sailors, and he's not. And everything he said actually came true. So the next time we'll finish up Acts, we'll do this last chapter and then sort of review just a little bit. But when you get to the end of the book of Acts, like I said, you can read it all in one sitting because it's just simply a story. But it's an interesting story, nevertheless. Anyone have any questions? Okay, this closing prayer. Father, thank you for the Apostle Paul. What a unique life he had. The persecutions that he underwent, the people that loved him so dearly, and the people that hated him so much. Father, I thank you for Paul, for your preservation of him, for we know now that he's able to begin to write, and he writes these tremendous epistles that we use as part of the New Testament. Father, I thank you for your providential care of Paul. I thank you for your providential care of us. I thank you in Christ's name. Amen.